This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How funny does this sound? An actress feels lost after her husband leaves her for a man. Her extreme mood swings become so extreme she ends up in a mental hospital and is diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Well, it isn't necessarily the plot that makes Carrie Fisher's new novel, The Best Awful, funny. It's her observations. The plot is based on her own life. The main character, Suzanne Vale, was also at the center of Fisher's best-selling novel, Postcards from the Edge. Meryl Streep played her in the movie adaptation. Like the character, Carrie Fisher is the daughter of celebrity parents. Her mother, Debbie Reynolds, and her father, Eddie Fisher, divorced when Carrie was young. Carrie Fisher's first brush with being a celebrity in her own right was when she played Princess Leia in Star Wars. Here's a short reading from the beginning of her novel, The Best Awful. The first chapter is called The Man Who Got the Man That Got Away.
Suzanne Vale had a problem, and it was the one she least liked thinking about. She'd had a child with someone who forgot to tell her he was gay. He forgot to tell her, and she forgot to notice. He might have forgotten to mention it because he hoped she would save him, making him into a normal family man with a wife and a child and a job running a studio. And hadn't she wanted to be saved from certain things also? From life alone, from being childless, from a life that might have looked a little sad from the outside? So merging their secret hopes for rescue, they'd had a baby with their unwritten pact of androgyny, an androgyny that informed the life they lived out loud. Suzanne had never seen herself as what she called a squeezy, tilty girl. She was a breadwinner with a very yang personality, a person who wore a lot of severely tailored little black suits. And Leland Franklin would never be called up for the Butch Patrol. Not that he was effeminate in any way. Far from it. Suzanne's pregnancy had betrayed their pact, however, transforming her into a girl, a vulnerable woman even, leaving Leland to be what he couldn't, a straight and certain man, certain of his sexuality anyway. Looking back, perhaps Suzanne should have guessed, based on his affection for Biedermeier furniture or even his fastidiousness with his grooming, she should have known when, toward the end, he'd begun rigorously attending a gym, perfecting a body she knew wasn't being perfected for her. Their alliance had broken under the strain of their attempt at normalcy gone wrong. When their daughter Honey was 3, Leland had left her for a man, though initially this was not what he'd said. He'd said he was leaving because Suzanne was crazy, kept him up all night, refused to take her bipolar medication, and she would talk all the time. Maybe she'd talked him out of staying with her, won the argument for why to leave her without meaning to.
That's Carrie Fisher reading from the opening of her new novel, The Best Awful. Carrie Fisher, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How much of this novel is based on your life?
Oh, a hell of a lot of it.
Right. Well, the father of your child left the marriage because he was gay. Was that a shock for you?
Oh, my God, yes. It's not, I've split up for all the usual reasons, and you can see those coming, the buffalo hooves on that one. You can sort of feel those coming from, you know, the distance in that prairie, but you can't sense the gay thing coming as easily. It comes from a different sort of... It doesn't come out of the blue. It comes out of a color you don't know.
When it happened, did it make you want to, like, replay the whole marriage and look for clues that you might not have noticed and rethink everything that happened?
Well, you always want to do that, but what you do more in this thing than you do in any other situation is you blame yourself. How dumb you were! So that... You know, you just, that's the thing that you do. It doesn't even matter what you replay. How could you not have known? So no matter what you're going to end up looking at, you're humiliated, and you just imagine that everyone's looking at you like, how dumb could she be? I mean, all of us, you know, could be cheated on with women and stuff like that, but it takes a special kind of idiot. That's what I thought anyway.
But I could easily imagine it feeling the other way around, that, you know, you didn't realize he was gay. He didn't realize he was gay, or at least he wasn't ready to act on it yet. And it's not like he was leaving you for another woman. It's not like another woman was
He was rejecting the whole
you.
Sex.
Well, he was just, he had changed, either in his orientation or on his ability to act on that orientation. So in a way, it's less personal. He's not rejecting you for another woman. It's just that you're not, women aren't it anymore for him.
Well, or I think they never really had been, but it's sort of, it doesn't matter, you're just squashed, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. There's no way you can philosophically take up some sort of flag and wave it to yourself and look in the mirror and say, okay, you know, I'm okay about this now. It takes a really long time, and I think I would have been better off with it had I not had a child. So that's why it took me a long time to write about it. It just wasn't funny to me. I think I would have been able to make it funny to me faster.
Can you talk about what that process is like of taking something that is like the really
awful,
most horrible thing that can happen to you, and then, you know, over time you turn it into a comic novel?
Look how long it took me.
How long?
Well, I was taking two really bad situations, and, you know, tragedy plus comedy, plus time is comedy. It took a lot of time to make a mental hospital and being left by a man for a man to be a joke. But they happened sort of a close, you know, on each other's heels, so it took me a while to make them funny. But I got there, and I knew it when I started being, you know, you get called, when I had my drug problem, and then after that I was the person who was called when other people had their drug problems. So now I get called when people get left, when women get left by a man for a man, and I get called when people are bipolar. And I get extra ones, too, just, you know, thrown in. But I know what to say now. I can make it a little easier. It's a drag being a pioneer on the, I say that I turn men gay. I say that it's my superpower. And, that was one of the things that I, when it was all very upset, and everything was upsetting in the beginning, and it was one of the first things that we were sort of arguing and everything was upsetting and crazy. And my ex sort of said, you know, maybe it was my fault because I sort of took codeine again and it was my fault that he was gay. And I said, oh, yeah, well, I didn't read that, you know, warning on the bottle. I thought it said, you know, heavy machinery, not homosexuality. I could have been, you know, riding those tractors all along.
Wait a minute. No, I thought that line is in the book. I thought
yes,
that was very funny. You actually said that in real life?
You see? That's why I say if my life wasn't funny, it would just be true, and that's just would be unacceptable. So, yes, that's true.
That's good to be able to quip like that in real life. Some people who do it can only do it on the page.
But, I mean, my life is sort of, not even sort of. My life is insane. It used to be sort of insane. Now I've actually been committed to an asylum. I don't think they call them asylums anymore. They've taken all the romance out of them.
Carrie Fisher is my guest, and her new novel is called The Best Awful. Now, you know, your character in the novel has two big problems. One is that her husband's left her for another man, and two is that she's becoming more extreme in her mood swings and is finally diagnosed as bipolar, manic depressive. And this has happened to you as well. Now, your character in the novel, when she's going through a manic period, will not only, like, just talk, she doesn't want to sleep. At 3 a.m, while the rest of her family is trying to sleep, she can be hammering away, trying to lift the, trying to redo the tiling on the patio at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
But she likes this manic phases, but then when she gets depressed, life becomes quite unbearable. What do you find so appealing about the manic part of manic depression?
Well, but what every manic does, I mean, it's liquid confidence. You feel everything that you do feels charmed and feels sort of like the best idea you've ever had in your life, and like you can do it better than anybody else and should do it. And have been chosen to do it by some god or other, and should stay up all night doing it, and should get everyone in the world up to do it with you. It's an extraordinary feeling, and it's unlike any drug, and I've taken all of those. And there is no drug that you can say, oh, it's just like, I mean, it's this amazing feeling of just being the chosen one. And it eventually goes terribly awry. But, you know, just imagine feeling just like nobody could resist you, just like you could do anything that you want to do. Any talent, anything that you pursue, you could get done.
And then when the mania gives way to depression, do you get depressed about the same things you'd previously been manic about?
Well, I used to say that the facts about my life stay the same. Just the fiction I make up about them differs. So, I mean, everything, it just, the light goes out of it. So it would be what Winston Churchill called the black dog then. You would just bleed the light out of the world. And it's weather. So on one day you have just this incredibly great weather and nothing you touch could go wrong. And then the next day it's horrible. It's horrible. And you know something, just pure evil is coming to get you, and you don't know from what source, but you're doomed. And you're powerless to keep that doom away from you.
Were you good at working during the manic periods, working on writing?
Of course. And there's a certain point when, of course not, because you can't sit still. But for a long period, if it goes for a long period, yes, absolutely. And then it just gets to a point where you cannot sit still and you're off to India.
How did you figure out that you were bipolar, that you had bipolar disorder?
Uh-huh. Somebody had to tell me, and I had to be told by a lot of different people over the years. I was told when I was 24, which I thought was very annoying. And they told me at 24, and I was still taking drugs, and you really, when someone's drug addicted or alcoholic and you're still taking a lot of substances or drinking a lot, that looks like manic depression. You can't really accurately diagnose someone, I think. Or I've been told that. So, but when I got sober for the first time when I was 28, I was told again, quite emphatically, and I believed it, or I said I would, you know, try it their way. And so I took lithium for a year, but I said I would take it, reserving the right to go off it if I didn't like it. So at the first opportunity, I went off lithium.
What didn't you like about it?
It put too much air in my world.
What does that mean?
And I just, I used to think I wanted to feel like others seemed, but I didn't have as much fun, and there were less surprises. So I was in Australia, and I went off the lithium, and I wanted to go to China because it was near. I ended up getting in a lot of trouble.
You know, in an earlier part of your life, you had drug problems and alcohol problems. Did you see that in retrospect as connecting to manic depression?
Well,
do you think you were trying to self-medicate?
Well, they say that. You know what? I think I would have had probably drug problems anyway because it's in my family. But they always say 60% of all manic depressives are drug addicts or alcoholics, and I always wanted to meet the other 40%. Because I'm wondering what the hell they were doing. Just like grooving on the moods. They're tough moods, you know. Well, I met the other 40% in the mental hospital. And they are grooving on the moods. I mean, they're just really talk about every inch and nook and cranny of the mood, and here's how I feel, and here's the medication I want and must have. And I think I'd rather be the 60%. But I don't, you know, I think that you would still be a drug addict. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card to be a manic depressive, and so I self-medicate, and that's why I'm a drug addict. I think they probably exist together and, you know, and separately, too. Yes, I self-medicate. And I think I would, given my family history and, I don't know, my predisposition, I'd probably have taken the drugs, too.
So what do you do now?
Just I do radio shows. I snort radio shows. You mean, what do I do now? In what way?
Are you for fun? No, for medication.
I take a lot of this dreck they give me for being a manic depressive. It's a horror. I take the little round watchful pills they give me to keep my moods under control. And that's it. I'm consigned to this sort of this way. I have to be under control. I do this. I have an 11-year-old daughter. I am not going to put my daughter under any sort of stresses. I've read, actually, it was the daughter of the Queen of Sheba. It was a book that a woman, I think, worked at NPR, right?
That's correct.
That book really disturbed me. It was very upsetting for me because it was written from the daughter of a manic depressive's point of view. And I just would never want to make my daughter's life like that.
Right.
And I don't think my daughter has seen me, certainly, manic. And, you know, she'd call my daughter called the moods the fast and slow. But I don't want to do that to my daughter. So even if I would be tempted to want to be manic again, which is amazing considering my age, me sort of running around Tijuana at 47.
In writing this novel, The Best Awful, about a woman who, like you, has bipolar disorder, did you have to stand back and see what that looks like?
Definitely.
From the point of view of, like, your friends, your family, your ex-husband.
Yeah, I don't, and the awful thing is to put that look in people's eyes, at any age, but, you know, at middle age, it's really insane. Yes, I had to stand back and look at it, and it's inappropriate at any age, but, and certainly, you know, you want people to have compassion, and then you just think, I'm really pushing this, you know. But I have to stand back and look at it like it's a character.
Mm-hmm. So is it helpful at all in getting control of it to have stood back and written about a character with bipolar disorder? Once you're in the grip of it, does it not really matter that you've been able to stand back?
But in the grip of it, I have this thing that is standing back and watching it.
Oh, yeah?
Which has probably saved my life half the time.
That's like the writerly part of you.
There's somebody watching.
Yeah.
The only reason I remember something in the 6 days that I stayed awake, which felt like I was going to die. I mean, that's how they torture people, you know, soldiers or whatever. I don't know what they do to the soldiers for keeping them awake. What do they get out of them? But I know now how they feel really pretty awful. But there was something in me tethered that stood back and watched. And it's that thing that can write the books. And I guess it's that thing that it's not cathartic, but it's that thing that's sort of sensible in me. That's, you know, that does make me write, that has always stayed there and watched, that's watched while I was, you know, children of celebrities, that's watched while I was married to a celebrity, that was, while I was Princess Leia, that has just watched all this stuff that's crazy, that doesn't make any sense on a sensible person.
Now, you were hospitalized when you had your psychotic incident, and part of the therapy, I think, was group therapy.
It was so awful. Yeah.
Well, but, you know, it strikes me you've been in 12-step programs.
Forever. I've done everything now.
Yeah, so what are some of the differences between, like, a 12-step program and group therapy in, you know, in a mental institution?
Oh, wait,
you're dealing
now,
with other people who are psychotic.
I don't know the difference. I've never been in, like, standard group therapy outside of, like, where I'm in a place.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been in rehab group therapy, I guess. And it's so awful. Because in the mental institute group therapy, you just feel like you're imprisoned there. And there's no real goal, I don't think. But in the mental hospital for 6 months, we talked about, remember the 40% of the manic depressives that weren't? We talked to them. And I listened to those people who wanted to talk about every area of their mood that they felt yesterday and this morning and at noon. And everybody talked, and it was all very critical. And we were there for 6 hours without break. Hmm. listening to everybody's everything in the boxes they moved. And their husband wouldn't help them move them and wouldn't talk to them that lunch. And it was unbelievable. And I'm sure, and I was boring too, and we all were trapped. And there wasn't really any goal. I mean, it wasn't like it was therapy. It was just talking. We were just there.
In the novel, your character is kind of forced to come out publicly as having, you know, bipolar disorder. Why don't you explain why she's forced to do that?
Well, she's in the hospital, and they put it in the what are they called? The tabloids, as, you know, Suzanne Vail's tragic life, which did happen to me. But it was I did get to get out of the hospital then.
Because of the tabloid?
Yeah.
What was the connection?
Well, because someone had sold my story, basically said something that I had said in the hospital.
Oh, even someone on the staff reported it?
No, one of the patients, I guess, somebody.
Oh.
And so they'd broken my anonymity or whatever, and I got to leave early. So it was, you know, anyway, so then it was out that I was bipolar. Anyway, it was out. So then once it was out, I sort of felt, well, if it's out their way, I kind of would rather have it come out my way. So I wanted to organize myself around how it was going to be said that I was bipolar, how it was going to be said that I was in the crazy house.
Is that part of the reason why you wrote this novel?
Part of it, yeah.
And so,
part of the reason why I write any of the things I write.
Right, right. But I'm sure you wanted to kind of have that explanation made public long before this novel was published, because the episode you're talking about was several years ago.
So, 6.
Okay, 6 years ago. So what did you do closer to that time?
Well, they came to me, you know, and would ask me to...
Who
reporters?
You
feel so dumb. Yeah. No, I think I went on Diane Sawyer. And you do feel dumb with... You know, I don't want to, the last thing I want to do is go on a show and weep and confess to my newest thing of the horror that happened. But I did go on a show and tell a thing that happened and talk about that thing. And there's no way to do like a laughing version, I suppose. But I never felt that bad about this somehow. And I still don't. And maybe I don't feel like it's that so horribly stigmatized or awful. And maybe there's something additional wrong with me that I don't. But I don't.
Is the public knowledge that you had this, you know, that you have manic depression, that you had this break, is that affecting your ability to get work, either as an actress or as a screenwriter?
No, I've worked, I've played 2 nuns since then. What does that say? I don't think it, not that I know of, nor I'm not privy to what happens in rooms where they decide whether I should have gotten something that I didn't get, but no, I work, I'm working pretty much. It probably my age works against me more than my manic depression. That's a bigger disease. Ageism. I think mental illness works for me and my age works against me. What about that?
Huh. Now, the character in your novel, like you, is the daughter of a celebrity mother who was a movie star and then sang in clubs. Your mother, of course, is Debbie Reynolds. What was the status of your mother's career when you were old enough to be conscious of that?
She was doing mostly clubs, I think. We were in Las Vegas a lot. And then I started doing nightclub work with her, like most teenagers. And then,
very funny.
And then I did, I was a chorus girl with her in New York, again, like most teenagers. Mostly I think we were in Las Vegas.
So when you were a chorus girl in your mother's act, what exactly were you doing?
I was dancing and singing.
What kind of songs?
Well, let me see. Oh, the play was Irene. So it was Irene, a little bit of salt and sweetness. It was all this sort of 20s stuff. I was 15. And
So you were in a musical. This wasn't a club act. This was a musical.
Oh, no. I was in a club act, though.
You were in a club
that
act,
was
too.
When I was 13. And I did sing one of Paul Simon's songs, Bridge Over Troubled Water, when I was 14.
Oh, foreshadowing what
yes.
was to happen
now,
in the future.
Yes. There's constant foreshadowing of weirdness. And so that's... See, if I didn't write about it, if it was just... Otherwise, it would just be true, you see? Well, it just is the weirdest life. So that's why I write it.
Now, what did being in Irene and being in your mother's club act look like to you as a young teenager? And this would have been in the late 60s, maybe?
No, let's see. I was born in 56. So when I was 15, what does that do for us? 71.
Okay. So, you know, this is a period when there's a lot of, like, radical politics and, you know, the kind of tail end of the hippie era. And I don't know what you were aspiring to, but there you were in Vegas. did it feel
Why
like
not?
Where you wanted
15,
to be?
15, I was in New York.
Oh, okay.
And before that, I was on the road doing her act, yeah. At 15, I was in New York, and we lived next to a funeral parlor. My mother was having her nervous breakdown. I was a chorus girl. I was in love with all the chorus boys. How about that for foreshadowing? Oh, just a huge amount of foreshadowing. And I think I got my first kiss from a gay guy. Oh, but that was on the road with the nightclub act. A guy named Lynn. He was Rip Taylor's boyfriend. That was great. And then I was in the chorus, and my mother was not in great shape. And I was a teenager, so I was living upstairs. She was downstairs. And then I went away to school in England, to drama college. My mother and I feuded a lot then.
And was it good to get away?
It was fantastic. By then, I didn't want to go to school in England, but it was good to get away when I finally did. She made me go, because I was going to bring respectability to the family.
In your novel, The Best Awful, your main character, who is the daughter of a celebrity, says that she thought a law ought to be passed forbidding two celebrities from actually breeding. It led to alcohol addiction and self-obsession without actually having a real sense of self. From your point of view, what are some of the problems of being the child of celebrities?
Well, celebrities are very busy. It's a narcissistic, unless you really concentrate, it can be a very, self-centered, self-oriented profession. That your product is yourself. So, you know, when you have a child, the child has to be the focus, right? Children are normally, you have a child, and then the child's the focus. But celebrities, their whole instrument is their self. And so the focus is off. Unless you have a very enlightened celebrity who's not going to do that. And it is, I think it's getting better now. And I was being glib when I wrote that. But the first crop of celebrities that had children, Tracy Ullman gave me a book that, a horrifying titled books of like, you know, suicide in show business. And it does suicide. It's not just like celebrities, and it's just everybody of like, you know, gaffers and cameramen. Uh-huh. And but it's
excuse
just
me for laughing. Yeah.
There's a huge rash of, you know, second generation kids.
Yeah.
That just did not, you know, and it's alarming. And I don't know what caused that, but it's frightening.
One more question. Do you ever go to the Star Wars conventions?
I don't know. I think I have. I think I've been to, yeah.
I assume there are Star Wars conventions.
I've been to an autograph thing of theirs.
Uh-huh.
And it was beyond belief. I wanted to make a documentary of the people that get in the outfits. One woman cried and said that I had inspired her. I said, to what end? What are you? She said, a lawyer. And I didn't know how Princess Leia had inspired her to be a lawyer. But, you know, I talk to a man who made cardboard. I meet all. It was very interesting.
What's your favorite line, or the line you think of as being most ridiculous from the original Star Wars film that you had to say?
I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion in this R2 unit. There's a couple of those like that. I know them still because I had to memorize them. Let's see. I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion. It's the whole speech of the, I still know it. That's what's so tragic. What if I get senile and that is all the stuff that I say while drooling? Years ago, you served my father in the Clone Wars. I'm some old, damaged, and they just are making fun of me and what the people do to me at night and just have me say Star Wars dialogue, and they bring in their friends, you know, the orderlies in the old folks' home that I'm in.
Oh, it sounds like an episode of The Twilight Zone.
That'll be my next book. Me as an old woman, having them dress me as Princess Leia in the old folks' home.
Well, Carrie Fisher, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Carrie Fisher's new novel is called The Best Awful.